This is Charlie Knorr with another story in my Defining Driftless series. Today, I feature a former monk called Santi Caro, now living in Norwalk, Wisconsin. Santi Caro lived in southern Thailand as a Buddhist monk from 1985 until 2004, where he studied under and translated for noted Buddhist teacher Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. Since 2006, he has lived with his wife Jo Marie Thompson near Norwalk, where they continue to develop Liberation Park, a 70-acre retreat center in Wisconsin's beautiful Driftless region. Teaching Buddhism and meditation, leading retreats, translating the work of his teacher, writing about Buddhist practice, and applying Buddhist principles to social issues are aspects of Santi Caro's ongoing practice. In this interview, I explore what impact Buddhism has on his life and our culture. What does suffering and the end of suffering mean to you in your daily life?
Suffering is when I have some unnecessary, unhelpful emotional reaction to something. Like last year, I was pretty sick, spent a lot of time dealing with healthcare, experienced a lot of pain and discomfort. That wasn't usually suffering. But when I would get annoyed at somebody for often a petty reason or a misperception, or this didn't happen so much when certain fears would get stirred up, that's what I felt as suffering. Or when I felt some procedures or some change in treatment was needed, especially one reversing one major procedure, and had to do a lot of kind of sumo wrestling with different teams of doctors, with the support of some doctors and eventually all of them, but kind of dealing with the bureaucracy of I was at Mayo, so, you know, a top flight major institution where the care was great, but you still got to play with the bureaucracy. And for me, there could be suffering in that feeling, the need to push, pushing too hard, worrying, did I screw things up, that sort of thing. A lot of it is what we might consider normal. Those are some examples of suffering.
So am I understanding right that suffering is a mental process and pain is a physical sensory process?
You could start there, but I wouldn't be cut and dried about it. Over time, as I've studied Buddhism, my own mind, and talk with people, I like precise cut and dried definitions, but I've learned that life's not always that way. So roughly, you could say that, but I wonder about things like sadness when somebody you love dies, or a beloved pet, or something in the world around us, a piece of nature gets clear-cut, or certain values are being stamped on by political structures or corporations. There's a natural sadness with those kinds of things, and I'm not sure where the line is between painful sadness and suffering. And maybe it's suffering, but I see it as often a pretty healthy one, because sadness, if we're attentive, can soften us and open us. Not everybody wants to soften and open, but for me, that's part of what life's about, being less defended, less rigid, less caught up in myself.
Are you talking about a letting go process?
Yeah, that's one word for it. Letting go of the ways I protect and armor against possible hurt. But when you do that, then you keep lots of things out. So I wonder about like sadness and also certain natural joys. Seeing an old friend. We've got a great set of barn cats right now. They're young and they're just so fun. You know, to just enjoy that, or a sunny day.
Right, today, for example.
A beautiful snowfall, our horses, a good conversation with friends about things that are meaningful. There's a natural joy in those. And I think if we just let these sort of things flow through, and these are mental things, they're not suffering.
It seems to me that that has to require an attention to what's flowing through, the emotions or the thoughts or whatever. And that isn't necessarily easy for everybody to do, or we're not, I wasn't taught to do that as a child, for example. Where does that part of the process take place? And how do you work on that part?
I agree, we're not generally taught this in our education, in family life, or in socialization processes. But we are taught to pay attention to some things, like if you're in Little League, you're taught to pay attention to certain stuff. If you grow up in the Midwest, like we did, then you're taught to pay attention to certain social conventions and mm-hmm. niceties and manners.
Right.
So we have that capacity, but it's generally not directed inward, and that takes training and practice.
Well, you've been working on this for a long time. How did Buddhism first become an attraction to you?
In a very vague, general way, it became intellectually attractive the last couple years of college, at the same time that the Bhagavad Gita, the Tao Te Ching, and other Asian stuff was attractive. Then it got more serious when I went to Thailand in the Peace Corps. And I chose Thailand over some alternatives because it was a Buddhist country. And I wanted, at that time, I saw myself doing a PhD in sociology of religion. And so I wanted to see a non-Christian country. Plus, I had some attractions to the way things were seen in some of the classics of Eastern philosophy, although I don't like calling it philosophy so much. So in Thailand, I was exposed to it as not a bunch of books, but a living tradition, customs. It was a culture I was very happy in, even though it's still foreign or different. But it was fun. I was in a rural part of Thailand on the Mekong River, mm-hmm. and I just enjoyed the people, and Buddhism wove through all of that. At the same mm-hmm. time, I started to learn to meditate and read some books by some leading Thai Buddhist teachers.
Such as?
The two most prominent was Ajahn Chah, who lived in the same province where I was based and had a lot of Western monks living with him. He was a monk. And then Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was more intellectually structured. Mm-hmm. He was more, and later I found out he had been the teacher of the Thai intellectuals, except for the real conservative ones. But the progressives tended to like him. And he became my teacher. I went to live with him after Peace Corps.
At a monastery in yes. Thailand yet, okay.
Yep, I was ordained near Bangkok by a friend of his, spent most of my time as a monk living with Ajahn Buddhadasa.
And how many years did you spend as a monk?
Over 19.
In Thailand?
The last four or were here in the States.
Okay.
And there was a transition year where I was bouncing back and forth, also spending time in Europe.
Tell me about your daily life with Ajahn Buddhadasa. When you were training as a monk, when you were learning, but I'm assuming you had other daily activities as well, responsibilities.
Yeah, well, it changed from the first year or two to later when I started playing a teaching role, because when I showed up, I spoke Thai pretty well and became increasingly fluent mm-hmm. enough to be on TV talk shows and
stuff
you?
Like okay,
that.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, or Thai radio. My typical day changed quite a bit. And then later, I was abbot of a little offshoot, and roughly we would get up around 4 in the morning, mm-hmm. although at the place I was abbot, we experimented with 3:30 and 4. Get up early, half hour later, do morning chanting together and meditate till dawn, then get ready and go out on alms round, which at times involved walking through swamps. Mm-hmm. And if you lost the trail, getting in some nasty muck. But it was fun, and it's a beautiful experience. You walk through the village in the early morning. There's a bit of ritual, but you're kind of visiting mm-hmm. the local folks. And
you've got a begging bowl with you?
Yeah, and you stand in
alms bowl, yeah.
You stand in front of their house, and somebody will come out. And the village I went to in later years, they didn't, until we started this little offshoot place, nobody went there for alms round. So at first we would just wander through and some people would say, oh, monks, please wait. But then there were the houses that would routinely give us rice. So we would go to those, and then other houses would be occasional and they would call us over. The middle-aged women in the village when they were kids had done a lot of stuff at the main Ajahn Buddhadasa's main monastery. So there's an observance day, kind of like the Buddhist Sabbath, except it's lunar. And we would go there and I would give a little talk. We'd give blessings, they'd feed us, and we'd chat. And so I heard over time from these women, their fond memories around the monastery. Mm, okay. So they were delighted to have us come.
When did you start teaching?
Oh, almost immediately.
You mean when you first entered the monastery?
Yeah.
And were you well enough versed? Were you a good teacher?
Well, probably depends who you ask. And when I look back, some of my enthusiasms are a bit embarrassing. But the way Ajahn Buddhadasa put it, when I questioned whether I should be doing it, and I didn't start teaching in a major way till I'd been there for 4 or 5 months and been a monk 9, 10 months. And the way he put it is, look, you know more than they do. Because where I was teaching, at the impetus of a previous American monk who really wanted to be a teacher, regular meditation retreats had been organized. And so when I showed up in the company of a more experienced French monk, we got channeled into helping, though my role was mainly to sit around and meditate and listen. But when the French monk left, and by the way, the American monk had kind of burned himself out on an ego trip and was never, I found out later, very stable. And this happens.
Yeah.
The motivations were quite confused. And so were mine early on. And that's part of being a teacher, is working through your own stuff so they're not interfering. But by the time I started playing a major teaching role, I had been around a while, listened to many talks by Ajahn Buddhadasa. I was unique in that of all the Westerners coming through, I could understand.
Because of your ability to understand Thai.
My fluency and read.
Yeah.
And so he would just say, look, you know more than them. Mm-hmm. And I would say, well, it's only intellectual knowledge. And he says, that's better than nothing. And then over time, the intellectual knowledge through practice is deepened through one's own experience. And then those both mature. And if you are doing your own work and interacting with people who are either brand new to this, or sometimes it's hard, people would come who've been meditating longer than me. And then at first I would feel bad about that or confused, and then just accept it and respect their experience and in cases learn from them.
But there's more to your Buddhist practice than meditation.
Oh yeah.
There is study, there is of course action.
Service,
yeah.
And practice is really a way of life. In American Buddhism, meditation and practice are often conflated, which is okay for a start because that's where a lot of people start. But life involves ethics, especially in the modern world, consumption patterns. If we're over-consuming, are we practicing a life of peace and compassion? Or what we consume, are we being compassionate to the environment, to people who have less privilege and power than us, and so on. So there's all kinds of ethical pieces, how we interrelate, how we converse, communicate.
Which brings me to the Eightfold Path. The Four Noble Truths, my version of the Four Noble Truths, are there is suffering, there's an end to suffering, and the end of suffering is by following the Eightfold Path. Maybe you would talk about it. I think you were just talking about appropriate action or right action, right speech, right livelihood.
The way I see it now, the Noble Eightfold Path is a teaching that structures a way of exploring life as path. So it's a very central way of talking about the way in Buddhism, but there are many other ways to talk about it. And so the elements you mentioned are sort of the ethical foundation of the path. And then there are the aspects that we call right view, how you understand life, how you think about things, your motivations in life. And those are aspects of the path as well. And then there are the more meditative aspects, right mindfulness, right effort. Talking in that way are to help us explore these pieces of the path. But it's not really the path till they're fitting together. They're not sequential, although you can talk about this supporting that. But ultimately, it's one path.
But is it possible to have right thought, right understanding without having the ethical parts of it? In other words, if you are out leading a life where you cheat people, can you follow the other parts of the path?
Well, on one hand, you start wherever you're able to start. And this doesn't matter if we're talking Buddhism, Christianity, 12 steps, any valid spiritual tradition. You start where you can. Very few of us are ever perfect. And I'm not even sure we want to aim for that. So you start where you can, and then you go from there. Now, if one's got some sort of pretty good intellectual understanding, or you can quote the Bible really well or whatever.
Which is where you came from, really. I mean, you were intellectually interested to begin with.
Right. But coming out of my Christian roots, I had a strong ethical sense. And even going back to junior high, I had contemplative moments that I didn't understand. But looking back, I could see pieces. That interest was in me, too. Plus, I was into fantasy literature, Lord of the Rings, and so I thought it'd be nifty to have some magic powers, too. My teacher knocked that out of me pretty quick.
Ajahn Buddhadasa said, just forget it.
He thought that was quite immature. He didn't deny that certain things happen, but to aim for that is considered wrong understanding. If one has intellectual understanding, but one's ethics are a mess, I would say one's understanding is quite weak or one-sided. Like somebody will go for the philosophy and want to talk about big cosmic things and will overlook like the ethics of how you relate to somebody at the Quick Trip. One thing that Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of many, many influences, not only on me, but within Thai Buddhism, or like I just led a retreat out in Washington, and something people often don't get, end of suffering usually gets pushed way into the future. Call it Nibbana, which is the word I use, or the more familiar Nirvana, which is Sanskrit.
Or enlightenment?
Well,
are we talking about similar words?
It could be, but I don't use enlightenment because it's confused with the European Enlightenment tradition and a lot of woo-woo-la-la verbiage. And a more proper word in Buddhism would be awakening, etymologically. But liberation, release, there's a number of words. Letting go. Because our egoistic minds see things as happening in time, It's partly about memory, but it's partly about ego, because ego, one of its functions is to be the vehicle that navigates time. Can't have ego without time. So part of that whole piece is when people hear the end of suffering, it sounds like it's going to be later. And then you can add some thinking that later starts to be further and further away, including after many, many lifetimes. Ajahn Buddhadasa didn't necessarily dispute that, but he didn't focus on it. And rather, what he tried to help us see are what he sometimes called the little nibbanas. And he would translate nibbana as coolness. There are moments when, for whatever reason, your ego's habits drop. Sometimes it's just you see a beautiful flower and now later, as soon as you want to run for your camera, your ego might be back. Mm-hmm. But there can be a moment. Or if you really hug somebody genuinely and drop the defenses without grasping, things like that, there are little nibbanas. And if we tune into those, and each one of those is an end to suffering, if we drop the time framework, there's suffering, suffering ends. There's suffering, suffering ends. And we learn to tune in more and more to the little ends, or I call them quenchings of suffering that are occurring every day.
Quenching because in that moment you give up thirsting or wanting?
Yep. The second noble truth is usually phrased, the origin of suffering is craving, and the word in the Indian languages literally means thirst. So in that sense, but also suffering is, in Buddhism especially, metaphorically seen as fire. The fires of greed, the fires of anger and hatred, the fires of fear and delusion, envy, and all egoistic reactions. And by reaction, I don't include non-egoistic responses like a really open, clean love or kindness or generosity.
Because that's not a reaction?
In my language, yeah.
Is this practice that we talk about, is the end result of this practice, one of the end results of this practice, to make appropriate responses as opposed to reactions?
Well, given what I just said, let's, instead of end result, let's talk about daily results.
That's what I mean, really.
Yes. And that also means when you catch yourself making a stupid, insensitive, hurtful reaction, you don't overreact to that by beating up on yourself, feeling guilty, making ridiculously obsequious apologies, but just go, oh, messed up. Own it inside, and if circumstances allow, own it.
Make amends where appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Like in AA.
Right.
And
right.
Also in program. Buddhist practices, or I think originally confession in Christianity was similar. Mm-hmm. But anything can get ritualized into a dead end as well.
It leads me to the questions about impermanence and not-self. Where do they fit in? And I guess I'd have to throw equanimity in here. So these are big questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, they fit in everywhere. Mm-hmm. One cool thing of Buddhist teachings as I've seen it, and I would say probably other traditions, but that's not my bailiwick, that if you follow any of the major threads, they inform each other. So impermanence runs through everything we've talked about. If there wasn't impermanence, there wouldn't be change. For one, you couldn't breathe. Your heart wouldn't beat. You wouldn't, you know, life without impermanence is totally unthinkable, totally impossible. But yet, we act as if there's permanence.
And when permanence becomes impermanent, we can have a tendency to let that create suffering.
Right. If we take impermanent stuff, which is everything, as permanent, then you think you can control it, own it, take it from somebody, fight over it. If there's enough mindfulness and you have, to some extent, digested impermanence on some level, then mindfulness accesses that. And it's actually that awareness on a deepening level can come into play in the ordinary activities of life. Well, clinging is then to take an experience and treat it as permanent. And so, yeah, even when things go great, it's got to just keep going.
What about not self? And I say it not self specifically because a lot of times I hear it as no self.
Right. Yeah, no self is a poor translation and gives it has kind of a feel of a philosophical position, which is not how I read Buddhism. Not self is actually impermanence seen more deeply or thoroughly. It's that the way the Buddha put it, like the Buddha never said there is no self. That's a philosophical position, and then you can debate, yes, there is a self, which nowadays is a big mess because psychologists use the word self in a wide variety of ways, some of which don't conflict with the Buddhist perspective of not self. Some do conflict.
Okay.
Depends what people are saying when they say there is a self. But for the Buddha, it's not philosophy. It's you can start with it as an idea, but it's more and more looking at life as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Mm-hmm. The point of which is to let go of the clinging and grasping we've been talking about, not only to things that are mine, my reputation, my hunger, my new sweater or jacket, my wife, my family, which, you know, my family's both got some nice stuff and often there's history that people aren't so happy with. But it's more deeply letting go is letting go of me, that like an identity we form around possession, around our subculture's values, you know, middle-class white guys or whatever.
Right.
We identify this is me, and it's not time to analyze that in depth, but if you really look at anything that you have this sense, this is me, this is what I am, this is who I am, it's changing, and it's interconnected with such a vast web of relationships, which is the flip side of not self, interrelatedness, which is another key Buddhist perspective. Things are so radically interrelated that you can't pull out one piece and say, this is an essence of anything, let alone who or what I am.
This is a lifetime work. Is it easier in a country with a Buddhist culture, like Thailand, for example?
I would say some things are easier. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of support, especially if you're a monk. And you live in a culture that's more in tune with your values. And to speak honestly, one isn't afraid of certain conservative religious people down the road being mean or opposing you just because you're not whatever congregation they are. And that has happened to us.
Okay.
So you don't have that, but there are advantages in being in the West. One, here in the States, you have access to all the Buddhist traditions. And if you're serious about these things, for me, that's a great resource because you can do a lot of cross-fertilization. Or here, people don't take, like to give a Christian example, there are a lot of people assume some ideas about God because that's what they grew up with. To them, it's just totally obvious. Well, it's not totally obvious to me, some of those ideas. And similar to Buddhist, if you were raised Buddhist, you believe things, or I would even say assume things, and some of them may not have been what the Buddha taught. And I'm not going to comment on other religions, but it seems to happen everywhere. So here in the States, people will challenge you. You're not the dominant intellectual tradition or the ethical foundation of the society. So that can be keep you on your toes, helps you to more deeply examine what you believe or think, not take it for granted.
Back to the United States then. There's been, in the past 20 years probably, that Buddhism has had an influence in the United States. And a lot of it started with the teachers that went to Thailand and studied with Ajahn Chah. People went to Burma and studied. People went to India. These were old kids of the 60s, I think.
Right.
That, and then brought these traditions back.
Also Japan.
And Japan, okay. With the Zen influence?
Yeah.
Okay.
In India was a lot of Tibetan stuff.
Right.
As well as other, my form of Buddhism, Theravada.
Theravada, yes. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that in a lot of ways, Buddhist thought has gotten sucked into commercialism and capitalism in a way that diminishes its effectiveness.
First, historically, Buddhism has gone into other cultures as it sort of faded out in India.
Right.
It went into cultures with other spiritual traditions. One thing that's fascinating and challenging is for Buddhists is that now, to a large extent, and not everybody will agree with what I'm about to say, mm-hmm. and it may be more true in Europe than it is in the U.S., but now Buddhism is interacting with primarily a non-religious value system. No matter what certain people want to say, the primary value system here is capitalism and consumerism.
Right.
So that's totally unique in Buddhist history. Now, another point for perspective is consumerism has developed very strongly in Thailand over the last 20 years, as well as Japan, although it's a different flavor than here. So Buddhism, even in cultures where it's been for hundreds of years or even a millennium or more,
right.
is also dealing with consumerism because that's kind of the biggest pseudo-religion in the world today. And I've been reading Vaclav Havel. They had consumerism in communist countries as well.
Hmm.
It was just a different spin and political structure. Buddhism is getting tangled up. For example, in Asia, it's common that you have free distribution publishers.
Yeah.
People will print books and give them away or sell them at cost.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little of that in the States, but if you want books in bookstores, you have to go through the market system. And by the way, some books I've translated are out there going through a nonprofit Buddhist publisher who then has to work with a for-profit distributor,
mm-hmm.
get into for-profit bookstores, or deal with Amazon, and then advertising. Because that's how it's done. So it's, or people who organize retreats, how do you get the word out there? There are alternative presses where you do so in a not-for-profit way, even if you pay some amount.
Mm-hmm. But on many newsstands in the United States now, you can pick out two or three glossy magazines that are dedicated to Buddhism. But they're filled with ads for the right cushion to sit on,
mm-hmm.
and the right Dharma center to go to for a retreat.
Right.
Has it lost its effectiveness because of this? Has it perverted the goal of liberation?
To some extent, it's perverted or at least distracted. But again, I've studied the history of religion, and by the way, Rita Gross in Eau Claire really focuses on this.
Okay.
That similar things have happened in pre-capitalist societies. They had their monarchies, their feudal structures. Now, Thailand still has more feudalism than the U.S. ever had. Actually, we've got our aristocracy, but so Buddhism has always had, and every tradition has to live in the marketplace, so to speak. And so the idea that you're sort of going to keep it pristine somehow.
Mm, and back in the monastery, yeah.
Then you end up with this kind of Buddhism which exists that creates a radical, and I would say life-sucking separation between the so-called world and the so-called monastery or spiritual fear. That's not how I see life or Buddhism. So these are our realities. And part of cultivating right view is to examine in ourselves and with those that we study and practice with, as well as say, Christians or Jews or secular humanists who are exploring the same issues. Feminists have to deal with this. Anybody who's looking for deeper truth. We look inside to see to what extent is consumerism influencing me a lot. What are those influences? And how does that affect suffering and the end of suffering? Not make it philosophical. How do those influence help me be a balanced, loving, ethical person? And to how much do they make me possessive, greedy, trapped in a narrow world of just getting what I want and not giving a bleep about all the suffering going around? Those are inquiries that each individual does and a healthy sangha or community will encourage. And I would say good teachers will encourage, but we can't ram it down people's throats.
If one dwells on suffering, how do you get by in a world filled with suffering? How do you prevent yourself from being overwhelmed by just reading the front page on the New York Times?
One, I read that stuff less than I used to. And I read more alternative political stuff anyway.
But there's plenty of suffering there as well.
There is some. There's a lot of gloom, and there's some wrong view in that. But I'll to more direct to your point, two main things. One is looking, keeping an eye open for the little nibbanas that are throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Just noticing when people are good to each other. It's real easy if you focus, at least for me, if I focus on the big structures to see a lot of doom and gloom. But that's not all that's going on. And there are magazines like Yes Magazine that try to highlight healthy stuff or people working towards that. So that's one piece. The other piece is opening up to suffering. There's one passage that I love where the Buddha talks about faith being supported by suffering. What that means, one of the things it means, is that when we let suffering touch us, it opens up a deeper sense. Sometimes I call it an instinct or a faith that there is non-suffering. And so you can't really separate the two. Part of the problem is when we separate them. And then you think this suffering is kind of permanent. A Catholic monk friend of mine once said, hell is to take any experience of suffering and start conceiving it as everlasting. Going through chemo and stuff, I did the opposite as a practice. This might go on forever.
Oh, so you consciously told yourself that.
I said it might. So instead of looking forward to when it's going to be over, which my mind would normally do, I would say, I'm not saying everybody should do what I did, but one of the many practices I did was this could go on forever. I may as well relax and focus on what's okay about this experience.
Tell me about Liberation Park. It's in Norwalk. When did you start it? What do you do?
It It started gradually when I left Thailand, came back to the States, and explored setting up a monastery and tried out ideas with a Tibetan nun, Chicago-born like me, or a group of Asian-born Chinese Buddhists. And then eventually ended up back in the Chicago area and Liberation Park as its own sort of entity. And we're 501c3 and all that stuff. We rented a place in Oak Park, Illinois, and made a lot of friends there, explored stuff. And we, at that phase, is at the center is my wife, Jo Marie, and myself, and then friends who are helping. We realized that we would be happier in a more rural place. Plus, we could never afford to buy in Oak Park, which has many attractive things, but its tax rate, and especially when the bubble, housing bubble, was still going. So then we looked for land, primarily in Wisconsin, and found our way to the Driftless and our current property, and were the 501c3 purchased it in 2006, and we moved up that fall. Since then, we've been slowly trying to build facilities, and we've now got some basic infrastructure, and I'm trying to finish the cabin so the two of us can really move in, because we've been renting an apartment in Norwalk. At the same time, making contact with, or usually people contacting me to teach. And so now have pretty healthy relationships with groups that, for example, folks in Viroqua, though that sort of broke down while I was sick.
Right.
But I'm back teaching regularly in La Crosse, Eau Claire, Milwaukee, starting up again in Chicago, Rochester, Minnesota, where I spent a lot of time last year. And that's not just me teaching, but it's a relationship with groups that function on their own. They're not my groups or our groups, but I'm offering them what I can. And some of them are coming out to Liberation Park for people who want to talk about meditation or different life issues, including politics from Buddhist perspectives, or alternative farming stuff from both. We're moving into a new phase as Jo Marie and I can actually start living there. Then our attention is going to shift more to building what we call hermitages, which will be very small, simple cabins that people can come and stay in. So far, people have been able to come and stay in very comfortable wall tents and a teepee. So we're hoping to build more accommodation, and we now have better infrastructure, like it's possible to shower on the property. And then we're working with a group of friends to sort of start planning more. I'm not a planner. I have ideas, but actually making a coherent plan you can follow, I don't do very well. So we're getting some help. We'll be making some decisions in addition to hermitage. Do we next build a meditation hall? Do we build a community building with kitchen, dining room, showers? And then how do we fund this stuff? For anybody listening to this, we welcome visitors. We have a website.
Yes.
If people want to follow up anything we've discussed, we'll try to be helpful and they can email us.
And the website is
liberationpark.org.
In November of 2010, Santi Caro was diagnosed with a highly aggressive form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. After receiving lengthy treatment at Mayo Clinic, he has recently been able to return to teaching.
Oh, no.
Yeah. many mouths, one that will be still so soon.
Mausam se dikha din nahi ye mukhtasar, zyada hai safarnama.
Much stands behind.
Mm-hmm.